Hello, friends. This is Andrew Sweeney from Parallax Academy. This is just a quick reminder to subscribe and like our YouTube channel and sign up for our newsletter to keep abreast of all of our activities. And if you want to get more involved, Parallax Academy has a membership program, coaching and mentorship, as well as several new courses and study groups. Come and join our convivial hub and network with some of the best thinkers, movers, and visionaries in the world today. And please consider contributing by becoming a patron or making a donation. Join us to help rebuild spirituality, rethink philosophy, and reimagine culture. Links to all of our activities are in the description below. Welcome, Luke, to Parallax Podcast. As you can see, I've already been drinking. We're here to talk about George Gurdjieff, who pioneered conscious drinking, I believe, which is not something I'm very good at. But I imagine you're better at that than me because you've been working in the Gurdjieff work. You've been doing the Gurdjieff work for many years. And I invited you because we have a little Gurdjieff group at Parallax. And we meet every 2 weeks on a Thursday night, and you lead us through these wonderful Gurdjieff exercises and give us a real transmission, I think, of the Gurdjieff work. So I wanted to let people know in our community that that's available if they want to come and check it out, and they can write me. And I also wanted to get to know you on a different kind of level, and find out a bit about your story. And ask you a few questions about the Gurdjieff work. So that's just a quick introduction. Maybe rather than just read off the bio you sent me, you could just say something about who you are, what you do, what are your concerns, what is your direction, what led you to the Gurdjieff, to the work of George Gurdjieff, who is, you know, some people don't know him, but a famous Armenian mystic who was big in the 1920s. And anyway, there's a whole story about Gurdjieff himself. And I guess what I want to do tonight is sort of have a query about why he's still relevant and in the present world as well. So anyway, that's a lot of information. So maybe you could just begin by introducing yourself.
Yes, no, no, thank you, Andrew. And thank you for inviting me. It's a wonderful opportunity. What led me to Mr. Gurdjieff's work? Well, that's, for me, still a big question. If I'm honest, I don't know. But if I trace something of my childhood, there were a number of experiences that I had which kind of led me to certain questions. Just, you know, what is life? What is death? Nothing overly strained when you're a child, but they're just natural questions, as children do. And then I was brought up in the country, in Australia, and then got the opportunity to live for a number of years in the outback of Australia with Indigenous tribes. And that had quite an impact on me. It's very raw. A very beautiful culture, a very brutal culture, but it really made an impression on me. And then, of course, I grew up, went to school, did what everybody else does. And these questions really didn't leave me alone. In fact, they only became more heightened, while at the same time, the inner chaos that I had felt as a young man was really kind of tearing me apart. And so I started to search for something. I think very unconsciously, right at the start, you know, you get a whisper of a conversation or a book. But then there was a bit more of a conscious search. And I started to read books and I've got a background in science, And so went through the education of science and all those sorts of things. And then eventually I came to a point in my life where my outer life seemed to be relatively successful, but my inner life was just very empty. And I think I'd come to a point where, in a sense, I wanted to end it all. But before I did that, I wanted to make one last effort. And so by luck, I'm not quite sure, I happened to come across the works of Gurdjieff. And what I found in him and his works and the books of students around him was a resonance. He seemed to be asking the same questions in the same way. But more importantly for me, I had a lot of the why questions and a lot of the what questions, but not really the how questions. I was brought up in the church, the Christian, you know, kind of sense of values. But what really irked me was this this edict, really, of to turn the other cheek or to love thy neighbor, love thy enemy even. And I couldn't do any of that. And so I had a sense of why and what, but no how. How does one go about loving? I just found that immensely, immensely difficult. But in Gurdjieff, I found, or at least had a sense of, a method and something that seemed to be coherent with many other things that I had either thought about or was brought up with.
So can I interrupt you there and maybe go back and ask a couple of questions that came out as I was listening to you? So yes. I was thinking about your background with Aborigine people, you know, primordial people, and then also your interest in science and thinking how that's like modernity versus, let's say, the more like the older, more primal cultures, and the huge contrast between those two cultures. And I was wondering how that affected your character, and that was my first question. My second query was, is it the fact that Gurdjieff has a very scientific approach towards the mind that attracted you to Gurdjieff, even though I don't know if you would call the fourth way science in the way we think of science today, but it because it's so strange, but there is a scientific aspect to Gurdjieff and a methodological aspect to Gurdjieff, which I think is like Eastern practice, like Zen or something like that, which rather than just in the Christian church, we often get a lot of propositions like how to behave and how to act and what to think and how to be. And but as you say, how do we put that all into practice?
Yeah. Yes. Well, to go to your first question, the exposure I had with the indigenous tribes really left an impression because it was very much in the body. When you're living on the land, you're not living with much and you're going out and hunting and eating your food and mixing in a culture where one almost lives every day as if it's your last. Those deep impressions, you know, the primitive, primal kind of urges that came up really impressed themselves on me. But really, I had a sense of being alive, really alive. But yet being brought up in a Western culture, and particularly in the church, where the intellect, logic, being rational was quite kind of dominant. I needed to find a way back to that aliveness. And I couldn't find my way back because I was no longer amongst the tribes or that indigenous culture. And it seemed to me that with Gurdjieff's work, particularly his emphasis to verify everything for yourself, and the emphasis of being in the body and being aligned with one's feelings and thoughts, that really nothing was more important than anything else, but everything needed to be in balance, in a sense. I found that as a path back to this sense of aliveness that I had almost every day and wanted to return to, because I felt as though I'd lost it. I lost it in the mindless ideas and machinations of modern life. And that's the pulling apart that I had felt. I felt kind of disembodied. So Gurdjieff was a bit of a lifeline. Ha, he was a method, maybe a method. A method whereby if I could have just a little bit of faith and try something and work hard, maybe I could find my way back to that aliveness that I was so yearning for.
And it seems like in some way that you've also reconciled with your Christian background, and what you all was describing is like this fall into fragmentation, which is very much the myth of the Christian myth.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so that's very interesting that you've also been able to reconcile that through Gurdjieff, and in a way I feel similar to you, in the sense that I went off and studied a lot of Tantric Buddhism and Zen and things like that. And this actually now is giving me a curiosity to explore the Western, the Western mystical traditions, all of them. So that's this whole process of getting lost, getting fragmented, getting broken, wandering around, feeling like you've lost your soul, and then the need to come back, which I can resonate in your story.
Yeah, yeah. No, I very much sometimes feel like the prodigal son. Yes, very much needed to go out and try all sorts of things. And before Gurdjieff, there was Zen and Hinduism and Buddhism and just about every other ism I could find. And while I found value in all of them, without question, it wasn't till I came across Gurdjieff that it seemed to contextualize it for the Western mind. And I found a bit of a resonance in the background that he had had, the mixed kind of culture that he had had, and his search, this never-ending yearning, what is there, what's essential? And yet at the same time, I wanted a rigor in that approach. I saw the follies of just going with anything. And a discipline, but yet also one that was freeform, and also one that really never required me to go into a cave or a monastery, but something that would allow me to explore all of these questions in the midst of life, and hopefully one day maybe even use the material of life for that inner work and that return to something. And I think that's what's driven me in that sense. And I've just been very fortunate to meet and work with some remarkable, honest, quiet, thankless people who've just helped to nurture something. And it takes an extraordinary amount of work even to move, one inch in oneself. When I was younger, I thought it was easy. Oh, I just do this and away we go. But it's incredibly difficult, yet that slight movement, that slight return back, even an inch or half an inch, just allow something that really nothing else can.
So I wonder maybe if we can talk about Gurdjieff a little bit to give people a bit of a context or who he was, because he comes across as a mischievous character, a guru, a crazy wisdom master, a trickster, He has these incredibly bizarre books, and also very well written, kind of like history of his life, and he's had a lot of influence on people. And I don't think he's very popular at the same time. I think he's had a huge influence, but I don't think he's a popular figure. Because I think that he's so challenging to our egos and to our images of himself that he can't really be easily marketed or sold to most. But yet there's still a lot, he's still alive in the culture, and there's still a lot of people who like us, who are interested in him. Why is that, and who was he?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't think anyone will ever know him. He seemed to be everything to everyone and kind of nothing to no one. But yes, he brought a very harsh kind of idea that maybe we're not what we think we are. And he challenged the very notion of being conscious, and just because we've, in the modern world, got a lot of kind of gadgets, that doesn't mean that we've moved any further than primitive man, in a sense. And that's a very harsh pill to swallow. It certainly was for me. The rebel in me when I first started out was trying to prove Gurdjieff wrong. Oh, no, I am conscious, Gurdjieff, you're not quite sure where you get these ideas from. And it's harrowing to begin to see that I'm not quite as awake as what I think. Mm. And so really when he first came onto the scene, at least in the Western world, well, Europe and the Western world, this message, particularly around World War One, where no one thought that there would ever be a world war, and yet there was. And the carnage that ensued from it kind of woke people up a bit, that maybe we're not as good as what we think we are. Maybe we need to pause and take a breath. Maybe we need to rethink the way that the world is moving. And so what I found interesting is he was very, very, very active between both world wars. In fact, almost his whole kind of teaching life was between World War One and World War Two, where the whole world was turned upside down and people were questioning everything. And he really brought that question of, we need to look at ourselves first. Don't try to change the world. We need to change ourselves. It's humans who are the problem. And we need to take a good look at that. But again, that's very hard to swallow, because we're brought up, particularly in the modern world, in the everything's about me, and look how far we've come. And Gurdjieff just really puts that into question. And I've found it really goes two ways. Either people hate him and call him all sorts of names, or one does ponder, well, what's he saying here? That doesn't mean one goes any further with him, but it really does mean, particularly in what's happened in the last 10 to 20 years, where is the world going? Where are we going? Where's my life going? And so some of the fundamentals, if you'd like, which is really what he was trying to get to, mm-hmm. how to get to those essential questions, in a way not to overthink them, but to really ponder them in the body, in the feelings, in the mind, and really come to something that might transform us rather than just endless talking about it. We needed to do something, but to do something, we really needed to be something. And so all of these very challenging questions, I think, make him a divisive kind of character. And that just seems to be the nature of his work. He wanted, I think, to cut through the bullshit.
Maybe that's the nature of truth, you know, in a sense. I mean, I'm not saying that he was the person who had the truth, but I think his ideas are, you know, are very challenging in the sense he wants us to see that he calls the terror of the situation.
Mm.
And he also talks about mechanical man and wants us to look at how mechanical we are, how unconscious we are, how asleep we are. And it's almost like all of his methods are sort of like harsh wake-up pills or something, at least in the beginning. But he also called himself the dance teacher, which makes me think there's also a quite joyous quality to the man simultaneously. So it's like, I think there's both there. Would you agree with me? Or
yes, no. My experiences were, and in many ways still are, harsh. To see things about yourself is very, very difficult. You know, I always thought of myself as an honest person, but then when you start to see that you lie, but to really see that, it's just very hard to take. But yet in a way, there's a strange freedom in that, is that one starts to see some of the roots of these things and one can begin to let go. And then something else can appear. Ah, I'm just like everyone else. I struggle with this. I struggle with being honest. I struggle with finding my way. I struggle in relationships. And so that harshness about seeing something that's contrary to the image that I have of myself is a two-edged sword in a way, mm-hmm. a hard pill to swallow, but yet at the same time, very liberating. And it's kind of like that. There's this joy and also the suffering that I also see with that joy. But in a way, I feel we need both. Can't have one or the other. There's something here. It's like hand in glove. I need to see as much as I possibly can, and that requires being brave to moving forward into that unknown of seeing. Well, what really am I? How do other people really see me, and not just what I think that they see me or what I think about myself. Mm-hmm. And so there's this interesting process that I think Gurdjieff was trying to get to, is once we slow down the amount of energy, if you'd like, that goes into these images that we're constantly trying to prop up about ourselves, something frees up in us, something becomes more available. And in a way, in that availability, I can be alive. But it's very difficult to get to, at least in my experience.
Mm-hmm. So what is Gurdjieff's notion of, you said, you know, of the self? I know self-remembrance is one of his principal practices. And when people talk about Gurdjieff practice, they talk about self-remembering practice.
Yes.
What are we remembering when we remember the self, and why is it remembering?
Yes. Yes, that word is loaded with all sorts of meaning, but just at a very practical level, Andrew, what you were going back to earlier about this sense of being pulled apart. To remember oneself really literally means to try to connect the parts of myself, to remember. And so some of those initial exercises in the Gurdjieff work is beginning to learn and find a way to connect my parts, so that maybe over time, all of the connections of these parts can coalesce into what we would call a self, something that's coherent and consistent. While we're torn apart, while we're spread thin and distributed, Gurdjieff would say we live in the small parts of ourselves. There's one of us that gets angry, that's one part. There's another one that's happy, that's another part. And there's another one that's hungry, that's another part. And so we live in this state of constantly moving between all of these parts like a carousel. But he said if we could find a way to connect these parts, to try to find a way to relate the parts, then maybe some sense of coherency can start to form.
Yeah. Yeah, in one of the groups you mentioned, and this has been something I've been thinking about, is that normally we think about sort of strengthening or improving parts of ourselves, like becoming smarter, becoming stronger, becoming, you know, kinder or whatever. But it's actually the work in the Gurdjieff system is about the connections. It's not about the parts in themselves. So it's very much of a holistic practice, which I think confuses people in the scientific paradigm, because in the scientific paradigm, we're used to looking at parts. And if one part doesn't make sense, then we say, oh, it doesn't make sense. And so I think Gurdjieff's work would make a lot more sense to people if people didn't try to just analyze it with their rational mind. Or I've noticed people that read Gurdjieff and they're like, what is this nonsense? But they don't understand what he's really up to.
No, there's this great tendency to kind of atomize everything.
Yeah, exactly.
And while I think that's valid, and there are certainly kind of aspects of his work where trying to develop the parts might be a useful thing. But really that essential work is how can I relate them? How can I relate my mind and my body? My mind and my feelings. And he speaks about this. He speaks about that there's a different language that we need to learn. This language of the body, this language of the feelings. We seem to always come about it in one way or another. And he talks about the three kind of categories of man, the intellectual man, the emotional man, the bodily man. And when I say man, I mean man and woman.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we see things lopsidedly. And so in a way, those initial parts of work is, well, how do I find a way to relate them? If I'm very much in the body, well, I need to explore my mind more and to find a way to connect with the body. If I'm more in my head, I need to find a way to connect with the body, and so on and so forth. And this interesting practice to remember oneself, to connect with oneself, over time, according to Gurdjieff, can form an I. That is, I don't see myself as my parts. I don't see myself as my thoughts or my feelings or my body, but maybe there's something else in the background that helps to connect all of them. And maybe I can be centered more in that rather than being drawn out to all of these parts of myself, while valid, are still only parts. And so this sense of coming towards wholeness, let's put it like that, can I be more engaged with myself and with the world at the same time? And the more I'm engaged with myself, the connection, the more I can be engaged with the world, because I'm bringing more of myself to the world, not just the intellect or an emotion or my body, but there's something that can be met in a very different way, but it's difficult. And he's at pains to say that it's not
easy. Meeting the world in a very different way. What is that all about? What does that entail?
Well, I maybe just a personal example. You know, many years ago when I was younger, a bit more prone to anger and the reactions that ensues from it. I used to get into all sorts of heated confrontations. Someone used to push a button of mine and I'd fly off the handle. And so that's how I met the world, angry. Mm. Someone pushes a button, that's it. I'm angry. I am angry. All of me is angry. But yet over time, my experience is if I can connect with my body and my feelings and my mind a little more, and if something is a bit more available in me, maybe when someone pushes my buttons, I don't automatically leap into anger. Maybe there's just a little space, a precious little space, where I have a choice to maybe go with the anger. It might be valid to do so, but I also have a choice to refrain. Maybe I just need to contain it and not go with that, because it might lead to something unhealthy.
Mm.
And so I found in that situation, I've met the world in a different way. And therefore the outcome of that kind of meeting also changes. And so that for me is remarkable. And this happens all day, every day. Moments with everyone I encounter or everything that I do, there is this opportunity to approach it in a different way and not just the same old ordinary way, my habitual way, as Gurdjieff would say, the mechanical way.
Yeah.
There's something left over that allows choice, literally the act of free will, which I seldom have when I'm in the mechanical, habitual way.
Yeah. So another question I had, which a bit earlier in what you were speaking about, how do we prevent these kind of practices that you would do, right? Which allow you to be available to the world, as you say, how do you prevent them from becoming solipsistic, and what is the need for the other, and what is the need for, let's say, not just the other person, but I know Gurdjieff has a notion of the divine or God, and what is his notion of that, and can we do this practice of breaking through this intense habit field that we are so enmeshed in? As you say, it's hard to break that. What is the need for others? Like in the Buddhist tradition, there's Sangha, and in other traditions, there's God, or, you know, the big other. What about the other?
Yes. Yes, I think it's common across a number of practices, but certainly in the Gurdjieff, working with others is essential. I need other people. They can be mirrors for me. All those little friction points. But also there's something else there. When people are working with each other with a common aim, and it may not need to be an outer aim, but an inner aim of sincerely just wanting to see, I want to see myself. It creates a very different energy, a very supportive energy. It's hazardous because when you put frictions in the mix, particularly conscious ones, there's a constant need to be vigilant, a constant need to help keep each other in check a little.
Hmm.
So working with others, I have found is I need them like I need air. You know, it's not an attachment thing or a social thing. It's I need you. I need you. Even now, just speaking with you, Andrew, it something arises in me because of the question that's in you helps me. And if it was just me, that question or this response would never exist. And so in a sense, I need you. I need others in that way because they can bring something out in me that I simply can't on my own. And then, of course, that leads to something a little bit a little bit larger. And Gurdjieff was an Orthodox Christian. Certainly, God was very important to him. It's strewn throughout all of his works. And he says something very interesting. That in a way, what his work was attempting to bring is a method or a how to try to put one's house in order, to try to be a good vehicle, a good container for some of these higher energies that come from far above us. And if we can balance ourselves a little, which will be unique to us. and while there are principles, it will be unique to us, that over time there can be something that can enter to fill that space of the self.
It's interesting. Sorry to interrupt. Please continue.
Sorry,
please
finish. Sorry.
I wanted to say that one of the reasons that I started this little Gurdjieff group, or at least the reason I wanted to study his works with other people, is he seems to be the kind of person that he has a kind of a meta practice, in the sense that it's the practice beyond all practice. So before you would ever be a Christian or a Buddhist or a Muslim or whatever the hell you are, you know, you need self-remembrance. And that's like before all of these things. So you can work with Gurdjieff if you're a Sufi, if you're an atheist, you know, no matter what. It seems like his methods can apply to almost anybody, even though it is deep spiritual work. And a lot of people did kind of accuse him of being a materialist or something like that. But I think that what makes him still relevant now is that kind of meta practice that he presents, which can help us with whatever tradition we're working with.
Yes. Yes, no, it does. And it was, one of his aims was to try to unshackle the methods, in a sense, from the religious language. And he had a great respect for all of the faiths. But over time, the language, the rituals, all of those things, at least what he felt for the modern man and woman, started to get in the way. Because there's a lot of kind of cultural kind of baggage that comes with that. And what I saw in him was this striving to bring everything down to the raw ingredients. You know, where do we really start from? And how could that be a way to begin to explore whatever culture or religion or career or job or life that I have? And I think, in a sense, that's what attracted me, just to unshackle everything and just to try to come at it in this very raw, essential way. You know, what are the energies and forces that flow through me? Not to name them, not to put a framework around it per se, but can I just be witness to it, suspend judgment and work with that? And see where that leads and trust where that leads, rather than being held down by all of these other opinions and kind of dogmas. And so I found that very, very freeing. And in a sense, yes, it really brought me back to my Christian faith, because I saw it in a completely new way, completely new. Which was refreshing and, again, very alive for me, where before it was kind of academic.
Propositional.
There was a way to work with it, that I could bring more of myself to it. I think that's the wonderful value. And certainly over my time, I've worked with many people from all sorts of faiths. It's been very eclectic and wonderful, because everyone brings something unique to that common work. So it's been so helpful.
I wonder about, you know, Gurdjieff's language. And, you know, you said he was a Christian. Probably a lot of Christians would disagree Because he's so, let's say, at times provocative, you know, like I think he said that Judas was Jesus's principal disciple, and
Yes.
also he will say things like, and he will use really bizarre terminologies, like kunda buffer, which sounds like something like kundalini, or you know, what is he talking about? Why is he using all this strange language? But there's a subversion of, let's say, the mechanical way we use religion or language, or right? There's something extremely subversive about Gurdjieff as well.
Yeah.
No.
Yes, he had he seemed to have his own unique approach, you know, which he made very clear in Baljibub's Tales, his magnum opus, as they call it, that he was trying to approach or tap into not one's consciousness, but the subconsciousness of the reader. He felt that that's really where search and the way to transform oneself lay. And so approaching Gurdjieff is very, very difficult because he, in a sense, has tried to formulate his approach in a non-automatic way. Hence all the uses of these crazy words where you really got to stop to think about, let alone try to pronounce. It stops you in your track, these long paragraphs, and it's an effort, an intentional effort to read and to read his books in a very, very different way, which is reminiscent of the exercises and the dances. He was very much, one needs to make an effort. One just can't be served up. You need to come to it, you need to eat and chew it. You need to struggle with it, then something can come of it. So if it's too easy, we don't value it. But if we struggle with it, really ponder on it, then that process, it seems to liberate something in us, and we can understand things in a way that maybe we couldn't if it was just told to us. Or we grafted someone else's opinions onto us, or we just read a book that was very easy to read. And that also makes an approach to Gurdjieff very difficult, because not only did he have a lot of harsh things to say about the modern world and modern people, but he also made it incredibly difficult to even approach what he said.
Yeah, he was famous for sort of kicking out his disciples as well.
Yes.
I'm not allowing somebody to become a single fan, you know, pushing people back on their own resources.
Yes.
I was thinking about Alan Watts' quote where he said that the Gurdjieff work in itself is there to push you out of the Gurdjieff work.
Yes.
So there is a kind of a, you know, a radical sort of, let's say, self-sufficiency that's required, perhaps. Or is that, maybe that's not the right word.
Well, it's yeah, no, he's. I mean, if you look at his aims and objectives and in the system that he brought, it was really to create independent people, people who have at least some semblance of a formed soul that could be
So
a
if you think about
vehicle for God.
someone
And so, in this sense of trying to create independent people, or at least supporting that process, they can't be dependent on you. And so, yes, he made very active attempts to ensure that his students weren't slaves to him in that sense. And that's also been a constant question, I think, for anybody who's tried to work with Gurdjieff's methods, and it's certainly one for me, in that we need each other. In a sense, we're dependent on each other, but also in a sense, I need to be independent. I need to have a strong sense of self so I can have an orientation in the world. And therein lies the paradox. We greatly need each other, but at the end of the day, we greatly don't.
Well, you raised something earlier about, you know, about communities of people who are doing conscious work together and how often that's more difficult than unconscious communities, in a sense, because everything is heightened and kind of intense. And I've seen sort of intentional communities which begin with a lot of goodwill and friendship and all the best motivations in the world get really ugly. And I think that happens a lot in spiritual communities. What can Gurdjieff and his life tell us about community?
Yeah. Well, the basis of a community, at least in my experience, ends up being very important. And I think for Gurdjieff, if one looks at his life, this endless search and being able to gather people around who also had the same kind of search, in a sense, lifts everything out of the ordinary. And my experience with communities who are based just in social friendships or a mutual material need.
It's not enough.
Tend to have not great outcomes. But if it's based in something more, if a relationship is based in work, based in an inner work or based in a faith, but the community is striving towards something higher than itself, and it becomes subordinate to it, in a sense. Then there's something that's able to form that sustains that community in a way that no other way can, because there is this collective kind of energy that's helping something move upwards rather than downwards. That's not to say it's not filled with, you know, all sorts of issues. It is. It's just natural with humans. You know, you get people in a room, there'll be all sorts of frictions. But fundamentally, if there's not this essential search for something in this kind of a consciousness that I'm willing to endure those frictions for the sake of this search, if that's absent, then the community generally implodes after a while.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so there's a real question of how to sustain that. Well, it's,
yeah.
In the Gurdjieff work, it's work sustains work. Work calls to work. If I can bring my work, my effort, my search, if I can stay as connected as I possibly can, it calls to others to do the same, and then that invites something more. So really, the response to how I respond in my community is very much about my work helps my community, not the other way around, though in many cases, the work of the community can also help me. But I need to be responsible that I bring something, I contribute something, and it's my inner work.
I think that's it. I think the responsibility is it. Because if you come to the group looking for something for you without contributing back, then the resentment begins and people are at each other's throats. They want to be taken care of in some kind of way, or treated in a very special way, or whatever. I mean, I don't want to be personal, but you've talked about leaving certain communities also, you know, that you were involved in with Gurdjieff, and why did you leave, and what's your mission right now? Where are you going right now? Perhaps this will be the last question I ask you before we invite people in to join the conversation.
Well, it's there's been this question that's been with me, I think, since about 2009, when there's much more of an explosion of the internet and the way we kind of digitally engage. There's something that's fundamentally changed, and I've seen it move through the Gurdjieff work, and I've seen it just and through other finding communities. Also, our population is aging, at least in the Western world. The demographics have changed. The way we interact and relate has changed. And while I certainly treasure the time I've had with the traditional groups that I've been with, and very much appreciative, I felt this kind of urgency to explore this question of how the Gurdjieff work, the system, how it may need to adapt to this world that's changing at an incredible pace. And very much inspired by Gurdjieff himself, it was always a work in progress for him, always trying to find ways to adapt. How could he bring this or bring that? And to keep a question alive, to keep a search alive, not to rigidify it, but to work with something and keep it there. And so I just found in the groups I was in, it just wasn't possible to search that question in the depth that I wanted to. So I left. Also, I needed to, from a personal point of view, coming back to this question of one thing a group can't afford you is to work without a group. And even though I'm working with people now, and it's wonderful, it's this sense of needing to stand on one's own feet, but also a sense of really trying to tackle something inwardly and outwardly that's needed. And I feel this question of how the world is changing needs another response. I don't know what that is. But there are many people like yourself who are exploring this in medium. And in my own way, I'm trying to, with all the experiences that I've had, trying to find a way with it. And so really this is an ongoing question for me, what's needed.
Yeah, it seems that we're living in a watershed moment or an enormous paradigm shift where, you know, everything is going in every direction, and that the old ways of doing things don't work, and the new ways haven't been created yet, and we're all kind of in between worlds, to quote my friend Zach Stein. So it's a very interesting time, and I think it's at a time very appropriate to the Gurdjieff work, because he was in between wars and in between worlds, and you know, he left Russia and moved to France, and he was always he was always on a never-ending journey, and he was always moving towards the chaos, it would seem, instead of away from it. So maybe that's a good thing, a lesson we can learn from him, rather than trying to retreat from whatever it is that's happening to us, is to go straight into the chaos. And even work on the internet and things like that.
Yes. And in a sense, you know, that's really the heart of the Gurdjieff work. It's a work in life. Every opportunity is an opportunity to work.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's invite everybody in. There's three people who are with us: Yusuf, Gerd, and Carrie. Do you have some questions? Inquiries, something that you want to bring to this conversation, and what I'll do is I'll remove the spotlight so we're all equal here, and then just open things up. Carrie has to go. Okay, well, thank you for being with us, Carrie, and take care.
I also can stay only 5 more minutes and have to attend to something else. Then sorry, But it was very interesting so far for me. Good questions, good talk.
Thank you very much, Gerd. Thank you for being here. Hey, Yusuf.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? How's it going?
Pretty good.
Yeah, sorry if I'm just walking outside, so I might be a little out of breath. But yeah, thank you for that, and thanks for also, you know, sharing your personal experience within the journey. I was curious about how your process of like reintegration was with the Gurdjieff work, and then how you said with your faith, because how that how you started out from, you know, the Christian background, and then you weren't finding the answers you were looking for, but after you started diving into the Gurdjieff work and started living through that, you seem to have like a, I don't know if reintegration is the right word, but how'd you move forward with Christianity again?
Yes. In a sense, I never really moved completely away from my Christian faith. I just really didn't engage with it because there were so many parts of the Bible and so many things that were explained to me that really didn't make sense at a practical level. At a conceptual level, I go, okay. And it wasn't until I began working very practically that there was just little bits that just started to appear. This notion of being asleep that Christ talks of. Be not asleep. Awake, arise. Some of these mysterious sayings that Christ had all of a sudden made much more sense to me. It was, okay. Yes, I've had an experience like that. I've had the experience where I suddenly wake up and I remember that I've been and had most of the day completely and utterly asleep, just going through the motions. So many times I've driven a car and I've gone from place A to place B and I don't remember how I got there, but there's just been a vague memory that something happened. I wasn't there. But yet there's moments where it's, I'm here. I'm alive. And then, of course, I go back to sleep again. This is something that takes me away. So when I began, and this was probably a good 10 years ago or so, to just come back to the Bible again in a very intentional way with the experiences and the practices, can I just see the Bible through a bit of a different lens? It just really opened up things for me. It was, okay, wow, this is what they've been saying for 4,000 years. I get some of it now. I see the truth in some of it, but it's so hidden because in a sense it does require certain types of experiences to understand certain types of ideas, or at least the way that they're written. And so I had a new appreciation of it. And so from there on I started to delve a lot more deeply and really saw a way that the how of the Gurdjieff work started to marry, at least for me, very completely with the what and the why of the Christian faith.
Yeah, that's...
Sorry, excuse me, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it does seem the Gurdjieff work is, like you're kind of like you were saying earlier too, is the essential aspect is waking up, like being awake. And so it also seems that that's how you now approach whichever faith did the practices, were there practices specifically from the faith that kind of, that were only available during the faith or through the faith through Christianity that you saw anew, that had to do more with, that you saw it through the lens of being awake? Like, I don't know if that's formulated well, but.
Yeah, yes. No, it's really helped me to see I can come to worship and prayer in a very, very different way. In the Gurdjieff work, one strives to connect the body, the feelings and the mind, to be more integrated, more whole. And I found for me that if I can sustain that and work with that, that when I can come to worship and prayer, it has much more potency for me anyway, than if I had that absence, if it was just repeating words or just in a congregation. There's something about bringing the body into prayer, the feelings into prayer, as well as the intellect into prayer, that gives it flesh, if I can put it like that.
We were talking with Stephen the other day, and he said that he's interested in Christian ideas and Eastern practice. I thought it was kind of interesting that, because he practices Tai Chi and meditation, and yet he's really a Christian, and he thinks about Christianity all the time. And he probably, so I think that's very interesting. I guess Gurdjieff sort of is on the cusp of East and West in that sense. I wonder, I wonder, like a lot of Christians, I think they don't have practices. They just believe in something, which is totally bizarre to me anyway, as somebody who practices something. And I guess a lot of Buddhists or a lot of, Muslims, it's the same. They just have a belief system. But what the hell is a belief system anyway? I mean, what does it do for you except maybe just give you a bit of comfort? Maybe it is useful to people. Maybe I'm being elitist or something.
No, I think there's a sense, well, my sense anyway, there are various kind of levels. It's just enough maybe for some people just to turn up to church on a Sunday, or just to be part of something. And I know many people like that they wish to be part of something but not participate. Other people wish to participate. Other people wish to. But for me, to try to live the precepts of Christ, what he taught, you need everything. The command of try to love God with all thy body, all thy soul, all thy mind, and love thy neighbor as oneself requires a total commitment, which means I need to practice at every moment as much as I possibly can. Can't just be left in my spare time. But that's incredibly, incredibly hard to do. And it's why we need the support of others and support of the church. But my sense is with you, Andrew, it needs to be a practice rooted in everyday life. Going to the toilet should be a form of worship.
Yeah.
Sure. Eating something.
And that's what monastic life was or is, basically.
Yeah.
But I guess the Gurdjieff work is that you can bring that into family life or ordinary life.
Yes. Yes. And my sense is it must be as best we can.
Yeah.
How do we bring it into life? Otherwise we just endlessly talk about it. But how do I love? How do I turn the other cheek? How? And the first premise that Gurdjieff says is I need to be here. I need to be present. I need to be as awake as I possibly can to remember myself. And from that place, there's a possibility. But if I start in sleep, who knows? Who knows where that goes?
Yeah. So the first step is recognizing the sleep, right?
Seeing it, yes, seeing it,
fully seeing it, fully going, uh-oh.
Yeah.
This is a dangerous business. Here I am. What the fuck am I doing?
Yeah, exactly. And not to lose heart, you know, it's, I know I've gone through many periods of, yeah, the what the fuck stuff. My God, I'm a terrible human being, but I'm like everyone else. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just as confused as everyone else. I'm just seeing it for the first time. Uh-huh. And to accept that little by little, you know, there's this wonderful humbling effect that can begin to take hold, that you know, I don't have to invest so much into all this other stuff. And there's this natural compassion I feel that arises. You know, it's like seeing a child walk for the first time. There's a natural compassion. You see them struggle with it. You've been there, and you know there's this wonderful energy that can be imparted. But it's easy to see sleep and all of these other things in other people, but I need to see it in myself first. That's hard. It needed, in my view, needed.
Yeah. So in a sense, like every bit of consciousness is a little, it has some value. That's what I'm getting from what you're saying. It's not, that's what the right attitude would be towards that. Otherwise, we're just going to be overwhelmed and we would die stricken in horror at the state of affairs.
Yeah, yes. Right? Now, Gurdjieff said it, no conscious effort is wasted. And yes, you know, if one puts one's intentions and aim into this seeing, it can help pull one out of the depressive, oh my God, what am I seeing type of states, because, well, this is what I need to see. I need to see it, but I need to see it, not someone tell me. I need to see it. I need to acknowledge it and have courage and bravery that, yep. But also there's these other things. It's not just, there is a chance to be awake. There is a chance for real joy and compassion and love. I can be different, even if it's only for moments. And then a question comes, how can I sustain that? And it becomes very practical. So there's such a gamut of things that you know, one can't get stuck on any one thing. There's, like you said, there's a constant movement, a constant journey. You see something and then I need to move on and work with that in a different way, and again and again. So it's a very individual journey, my sense is. One must be very alive to it, yeah.
I like your emphasis on practicality, because, you know, I think I get caught up in the metaphysics a lot. That it's very, like the spiritual path is very basic and practical and rudimentary and starts at the bottom, you know?
Yeah. Well, there does seem to be this, what's the word? An abrogation of the flesh. The flesh is nothing, but a very spiritual thing. If someone is hungry, then give them food. You know, if there's need, whether it's the physical needs of the body or if it's just a hug, to recognize that that's needed and to move towards that and know that it's needed and only you can provide what is needed, is inherently spiritual, inherently practical. You're serving something here and now. But also, you know, there's this question of what else am I serving? Because I can recognize these impulses that come in me to help my fellow man, to help me, maybe even a service to God in those little moments. And I know for me, I sometimes get lost in all the big stuff, you know, trying to storm the gates of heaven and shake hands with God when maybe just a hug's needed for someone, or give them a bit of food, or just listen to them. Those things I find incredibly difficult. Yes, it's by no means easy. But to ground it in that practicality, and that's one of the things which really drew me to Gurdjieff's ideas, is I see a coherency in his cosmology, anthropology, and psychology. I feel its practicality. And in a sense, that gives me a renewed assertion of purpose. I'm needed. I was born into this world and I'm needed. I don't know what for yet, but I'm needed. I really am needed.
I think you've answered this question already, but, you know, Gurdjieff has a whole, you know, as you say, mythology, which is very different. Is it a question, is it something like that we need to sort of always be renewing the old mythologies and making them new? And if we really looked into Gurdjieff's stuff, we could probably find it in ancient texts as well, but it's just a question of this constant creativity and need for renewal, you know?
Yeah.
But what about the creative and the creative aspect? Cause you know, we talk a lot about the suffering in the Gurdjieff work, but.
Yes, yes. I find it inherently creative because one is needing to see what's needed for one's work. I see something and then it's like, okay, how do I work with that? And that is a creative, very creative aspect. And Gurdjieff, I'm sure, would say that nothing's new under the sun. But this creative act of constant renewal, constantly trying to find this essentialness, you know, God needs us just as much as we need him, you know, and how do we renew that relationship and renew the relationship in ourselves and with others, I find is a constant source for work. There's no formula. If there was, I wish someone would tell me. But because things change as I get older, I change. The situations change, and so I need to be adaptive and vigilant in what's needed here. And my work has taken all sorts of twists and turns because it's what's needed.
Yeah, we need to really adapt to what's needed. There's an adaptability and a dynamism that we need to cultivate. That's part of the work, so that we don't become habitual and stuck in various really deep mechanical patterns. And
it's so easy, at least for me, to get stuck into ritual and regulation, which becomes habit. There's a saying, you know, the worst thing about the work is the work, because that can also be a habit. You know, you get into a ritualized form of it and it ceases to be something alive for you. So there's this balance. I need a discipline, but at the same time, I need to be free to really look at what I need.
Yeah, that's good. That's important. And sometimes you need to move out of a structure that's not serving you, even if that structure did serve you at one point in time and was very useful. It's no longer useful. I think one of the hardest things we have is to let go of the past. That seems to be very difficult for human beings. No? Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. To begin again is a saying I love coming out of the work, to begin again, to really begin again, which means in a sense I need to let go of the past, but it's really difficult to do. How do I even begin to let go? But this sense of coming to something new and fresh, even though I may have done it 1,000 times, for me, it's like life, you know. I get up for work every morning, or I get the children ready for school. I've done it 1,000 times, but can I come to it again, afresh, new, with eyes open, like unto babes? It's, and then something changes, but it's not enough to say that. It's, I need to work at it.
Mm-hmm. Yusuf, do you have any thoughts, anything you want to throw in here?
No, it's a lot of good reminders, though, and it is hard. The work is hard. But it's, yeah, there's always like the knowing what you have to do. There's always like that. It's never, whenever you hear these things, I don't know, it's never like, oh, it was like, I never thought, I didn't know it was like this. I mean, sometimes you learn something like a new technique or something, but for the most part, it's just the same thing.
Maybe that's what
wherever you are, just meet yourself. Yeah, just meet yourself wherever you are. I was wondering when I heard the conscious drinking thing, I thought that was strange. What is up with that?
Maybe Luke knows more than me, but you know, when you drink alcohol, you tend to just kind of fall asleep, right? So yeah. How do you keep consciousness there while you're drinking? And I think they're just called that conscious drinking.
Just a attempt to stay present.
Just keep your conscious there while you go into different states. And I think he took that to some quite extraordinary extremes.
Seems no, paradoxical, you say, but yeah. Say,
not even in drinking, but just in car, you know, in his race car driving and things like that. Yeah, conscious drinking. Well, I was feeling kind of like, before this conversation, I was feeling like overworked and tired and just kind of like my mind felt like a block and there's just nothing happening there. And I was like, how am I going to bring something interesting to this conversation with Luke? And so I said, okay, I'll have a glass of wine because it might loosen something up in my spirit. And that can go either of one ways. It can just make me stupid, right? Or it can actually just loosen something up in my spirit and, you know, allow some consciousness to flow through. It can be both. So drinking, we often approach drinking very moralistically, I think. It's like, or else it is just an escape. You know, there's a rabbi I was listening to on YouTube who was talking about you should drink when you're, not when you're sad and you want to feel better, but you should drink when you're for joy or something. You should drink to celebrate. That might be a better way to drink than to drink to forget or to drink to become more asleep.
That's interesting.
Does that make sense to you, Luke? What?
Yes. No, I've worked with drinking. It's interesting what you say, Andrew. And certainly my approach normally to drinking is I just want to get drunk. I want to be something completely different, right? I don't want to be myself. I want to be this relaxed, loose, don't care what I say person. But if I have experimented with, if I can connect with the body, be grounded in the body, and she said, have that sense of consciousness, I can drink and not get drunk. But as soon as I let that go, I'm inebriated. And you see this in life when people suddenly sober up. It's very interesting how this quality of energy, what we call consciousness, when it's really present, completely changes the physiology of our being, literally. I find that fascinating. And we don't pay enough attention to it. So Gurdjieff's, in a sense, work with the body and all the energy and forces that flow through it is to recognize that these energies, conscious energy, the quality of attention, has an impact on us in a way that other things don't. And that's, in a sense, to study that. And conscious drinking is a way to study that if I allow myself to just flip-flop, I get drunk very easily. But if I can bring a work to it, if I can bring consciousness, a sense, an embodiment to it, something changes, irrespective of how much I drink.
I have a story. I met a kind of a powerful, let's say, yogi of some sort, right? And they say that, you know, the yogis drink to get sober. Because because normally they're in this very blissful state of mind, really advanced yogis, and they need to come down and talk to us and you know, communicate with us. So they drink to get sober. And I didn't really believe this. I thought this was sort of a, you know, a fanciful story. But I met somebody like that. And when I walked into the room with this person, he was acting all kind of like this, you know, very strange behaviors and saying oddball things and, you know, just being wacky and weird. And then he took a whole bottle of rum and drank it in one gulp, and then proceeded to, you know, elaborate this very beautiful teaching, you know, on advanced Buddhist philosophy, just like that, very clear-minded. So
seems like an advanced practice.
I think that's an advanced practice. I could not do it. I would probably die if I drank that much alcohol. You know, I'd probably be in the hospital. But he told me, oh, this is nothing, because there's some yogis in Tibet that can drink mercury, and they're fine. Anyway, that's a story, but. I think Gurdjieff drinking was a bit something like that, but.
Yes, he tended to use alcohol in many different ways.
And he would get his students quite drunk oft, and they wouldn't be able to, as a kind of a test, right? They wouldn't be able to keep their consciousness, and he would remain conscious or whatever he was doing, but.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah, I think there's some of that, but there's also, you know, depending upon even the foods you eat or the alcohol you drink, there's another side of you that comes out. It's often a side that everyone keeps hidden. So it's a way of, I know in many cultures, and certainly in the Australian culture, how you get to know someone is go down to the pub and have a number of beers with them. You want to see their true face, not the socially confined or corporate, the facade that normally comes up.
Yeah.
You want to see what they're really like. And so that's an acknowledgement, I think, in our culture of these two sides to us.
Well, there is the waking up part of spirituality, but there's also the intoxication part. And the intoxication part is like intoxicating the ego. It's often the poisons are used in a way, in a kind of a homeopathic way to, you know, this is, I think shamanistic cultures know this. Probably they know this in Aboriginal cultures. In many, many, many cultures, there's a use for intoxication. A ritual use of intoxication, not just sort of like, I think normally that a lot of people use drugs and intoxication as a kind of recreation, but which it can be a relaxation, you know, social lubricant, but there's also healing ways where, but you have to go through hell first. You have to experience your mind's darkness, or you have to go through the heavens and the hells and the ecstasies, and then you come out the other end.
Yeah.
At least that's what I understand.
Yeah. Yes.
So we come for circles to Gurdjieff and drinking. I have no more wine in my glass. I'd have to go downstairs to get some wine. I can't drink. I wish I could have a drink of toast with you guys for this fine conversation.